You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 5th of March 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London, with me, Tom Edwards. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, the rest of the world may be opening their doors for Brazil, but the UK is bidding to change its visa entrance rules in an apparent bid to crack down on illegal immigration. We'll have the latest. Communist leaders are gathered in Beijing for the start of the National People's Congress, and their tone seems to have shifted towards bridging the gap between rich and poor. Is it just talk?
The messages we're seeing out of this party congress of a party that is trying to sort of wrestle with these problems and figure out how it can move forwards on some of them, I think is all a positive signal. I think it's reactive to a sense of public concern that they feel.
And we head to Switzerland for the annual Geneva Motor Show to see what turbocharged news has got everyone talking.
Seems like the kind of kinetic and green message is slightly getting lost, because I think it looks like they're looking at new markets and maybe heading for performance and luxury a bit more in Russia, China and South America.
Plus, we'll find out why a sports channel may be the last piece in Rupert Murdoch's media empire, and we'll play some great music too, all to come in the next hour, right here on Midori House. Plenty to pack into the next 60 minutes, but before we get started, let's get the latest news from around the world with Jonathan Wheatley.
Jordan's King Abdullah has called for a political transition in Syria during his official visit to the Turkish capital today. King Abdullah, at a news conference in Ankara with the Turkish President Abdullah Gül, said that his main concern, though, was the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
I'm here obviously also to discuss the Syrian crisis. There is an urgent need for a political transition that puts an immediate end to the bloodshed, restore security, and security and preserve the territorial integrity and unity of the Syrian people. And only an inclusive transition will stop sectarian conflict and avoid fragmentation of Syria.
Greek farmers ditched their fields today and took to the streets of Athens to protest against austerity measures that have caused production costs to rise while consumption has dropped. Around 2,000 farmers who came from across the country for the protest said that without cheaper fuel and tax breaks, they would not be able to make a living anymore. Dutch police said today that the arrest of a Romanian woman living in the Netherlands provided insight into the audacious theft of paintings, including a Picasso and a Monet from an art gallery in Rotterdam last October. The 19-year-old woman was the girlfriend of one of two Romanian men arrested in Romania in January in connection with the heist, one of the most dramatic in years, in which seven paintings were stolen. Ronald Eckers is a spokesman for the Rotterdam police.
Well, this is a small step. It's a small piece of the puzzle that we have now, but it's important for us. We have the house where we think the seven paintings were stashed. That's really good information for us. We have another suspect that we can interrogate. So maybe this is another step in the right direction, but the real breakthrough is when we find those seven paintings, and that hasn't been the case so far.
Britain was left isolated in Europe today after it failed to secure backing to water down new European Union rules, limiting bankers' bonuses, a measure that could threaten London's dominance as a financial centre. The rules, which would limit bankers' bonuses to the equivalent of their salary, or two times their salary if shareholders agree, are set to be introduced next year and would represent the toughest bonus regime anywhere in the world. Police in the Maldives have arrested the former president today, 10 days after he left the Indian High Commission, where he'd taken refuge to avoid detention. India's Minister of External Affairs, Syed Akbar Rudin, called for calm in the country.
We have received information regarding the arrest of President Nasheed following a warrant issued by the Hul Humale Magistrates Court. India expects due process and the rule of law would be followed. We would urge all concerned to exercise caution and restraint and not to resort to any violence or extra-constitutional means. We are closely monitoring the situation.
And finally, in the United States, a Washington state lawmaker has apologized for telling a bike store owner in a spat over a proposed bike fee that bicyclists can cause pollution just by breathing out carbon dioxide. Ed Orcutt, a ranking Republican member of the state House of Representatives Transportation Committee, said in an email exchange with the bike shop owner that drivers and bicyclists should both share the burden of preserving the roads they use. And that's the latest news here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Jonathan. I was going to say, you're always a breath of fresh air.
Thank you. Thank you, Tom.
A pleasure, of course. It's 5 minutes past 1800 hours here in London. You're with Midori House on Monocle 24.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
Where are you, London? This is Monaco 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London, Europe, top.
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monaco 24.
You're with Midori House live from Studio One here in London. Now, a battle is brewing within British Prime Minister David Cameron's cabinet between those that want to relax visa entry rules in a bid to bolster trading ties and those that want to tighten them. Home Secretary Theresa May is proposing a new series of visa restrictions aimed at Brazil. Currently, Brazilians are able to travel to the UK without a visa for up to 6 months at a time. But these rules would scrap that allowance. The proposal comes at a time when others within the British government are arguing for stronger links and closer economic ties with Brazil. The Foreign Secretary and Chancellor have publicly clashed with May over the new measures. Other countries recognising the potential economic importance of Brazil are doing exactly the opposite. Both Australia and the US have relaxed their entry rules to encourage more growth. So how could these proposals by May hurt the Brazilian-British relationship? Well, I'm joined in the studio by Monocle's very own Brazilian, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and also on the line from Brazil by the Financial Times Bureau Chief, Joe Leahy. Joe, if I can come to you first of all and just ask, what's Brazil been making of this rumbling row over here in London? Is there a sense of confusion about why on earth we would be looking to make these changes now?
Hi, Tom. Yeah, absolutely. At this stage, it's very early days. We haven't had an official reaction from the government yet, but Brazil's policy is always to undertake reciprocal action when another country does this sort of thing. And quite frankly, after the successful campaigns by Britain to raise its profile in Brazil with visits by Prince Harry and the Great Campaign, I think this is going to be confusing for people over here.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that because obviously we had a very high-profile visit by Cameron to Sao Paulo, Rio as well, a large business delegation. Do you think that there's a danger that people in Brazil will say, well, hang on, this is quite transparent. Britain and Cameron are interested in, you know, basically making a lot of cash, but they're not really interested in maintaining the relationship where it really matters, where it's about people?
Yeah, that's exactly the way it could be taken. Brazilians are... tend to be, without generalising, tend to value relationships and be value personability, if you like. And the visits by Cameron and by the Prince, I think they went down very well over here. People did develop a sense of this sort of warming relationship of the friendship, if you like. But then when it comes to, suddenly the visas are going to be reversed and there's no real rationale and Brazilians are being accused of overstaying, I think it just sends the opposite message to what the government was trying to send with these other delegations.
Now, that's the view, obviously, from Brazil. Fernando, I wonder what you've made of these announcements and pronouncements by Theresa May. I gather you're rather surprised and I'm presumably rather disappointed as well.
I'm quite disappointed, Tom. I don't think it was a wise decision. And I'm quite surprised that this has been done now. Because actually, I mean, we have actually quite a few illegal Brazilian immigrants living in the UK. But I have to say, like 10 years ago, the problem was much worse. Because I've been reading other articles. There's a lot of Brazilians returning to Brazil because our economy is doing better and people have a chance to get a job back in Brazil. So I'm not sure what is she aiming for. And I agree with Joe. It is, I think, would be quite damaging in the relationship between both countries, because I do think Brazilians care about that. And sometimes they can become very emotional and say, I mean, why I would go to the UK if it's becoming harder and harder to go there?
Well, I was going to ask you about that exact question. I mean, what do you think the response of particularly, you know, younger people who might be looking to make a move to come to the UK to sort of join in, as Joe alluded to, the Great campaign to see what Great Britain is all about? Do you think this really risks upsetting that next generation?
I do think so. And I can tell you, even from my personal experience, I have friends who wanted to study abroad, and actually they're choosing other countries, like you mentioned, Australia is making it easier to Brazilians. And I have a feeling, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think Australia is actually now and the US, they're better than Britain in attracting Brazilian students. And it was not the case in the past.
Joe, if I can come back to you then. You mentioned that idea of some kind of, you know, reciprocal, almost a tit for tat. I mean, no one wants to see that kind of diplomatic spat. But what do you think the response from Brazil is likely to be in terms of diplomatic action or changes to their own visa regulations? Are we likely to see an immediate sort of counterpunch?
I don't think we will, Tom. I think what will happen is we'll see if Britain is really going to implement this, these policies. I'll wait to see, to let this thing fight itself out within the cabinet. And then if Britain does go ahead with it, you can be sure that immediately Brazil will do exactly the same thing.
And Joe, just on the idea of, you know, what Britain's trying to do, there's obviously a lot of different attitudes within even the Conservative Party, certainly within the coalition government. It sometimes seems rather conflicted in terms of wanting to crack down on illegal immigration, but then also saying, hey, we're open for business. We particularly want, you know, the best and brightest students, for example, to come over. Do you think Britain risks almost losing its way with this debate? Is there a problem that they really need to address about what exactly the message they're trying to broadcast, not just to Brazil, but to the whole world, is at this point?
Sorry, Tom, I lost that message. I lost that question a little bit there just because of the line, if you wouldn't mind just repeating.
Oh, sorry, yeah, I was just saying, do you think that there's a danger that Britain can be seen to be losing its way in terms of its immigration policy, whilst on the one hand trying to attract the best and brightest, at the same time having this rather sort of almost reactionary side?
Yes, I think this is really the danger, because there's also a program underway in Brazil called Science Without Frontiers, in which Brazil is paying a lot of money to send the best and the brightest abroad to the best universities in the world. Britain is one of the main recipients of people from this program, of students. And you can imagine the repercussions if people lose the inclination to come to the UK, if they feel that, you know, that there's a little bit of schizophrenia, if you like, going on there. You lose these people, and then, of course, that has repercussions into the future, because they become more friendly when they graduate. They'll become more business friendly, if you like, towards other countries, the US or Australia or other countries where they studied. So I think this has future implications as well, that perhaps the government is not counting on. And then one final other point that we should note as well is that Brazil is looking to the UK as a partner for the 2016 Olympics in terms of giving advice, because the London Olympics pointed the way in many ways for Brazil in terms of, you know, organising big cities to receive games. So I think London, or at least the UK, stands to lose perhaps on that as well if they don't manage this relationship carefully.
And Tom, actually, may I add something else as well? I know Joe wrote about that. Another reason for Teresa to change her mind is actually Brazilians are big spenders, you know? Actually, in Joe's article today at the Financial Times, it's mentioned that Brazilians spend $16 billion more overseas than international travelers spend in Brazil. So, yeah, I think I'll have a talk with Teresa, you know?
That's a very hard argument for Theresa May. I don't think she's going to win this one. Joe Leahy for the Financial Times Brazil Bureau Chief, our own Fernando Pacheco, thank you both very much for joining us. Coming up next, could we be seeing the start of a shift in attitude among the Chinese leadership?
Inspiration comes from finding new ventures that combine traditions with an original contemporary approach, especially when it comes to food. Monocle Films visits Toronto, Lisbon, and Thessaloniki to discover some sweet recipes for success.
Nadege, along with her small but dedicated crew of pastry chefs, create every morsel on site in a large open kitchen connected to the main dining area. It's here that they balance flavor with color, texture with geometry, and creativity with shelf appeal.
Taste with your eyes on monocle.com.
Wake up in Asia or sip a nightcap in Europe to the Monocle Daily, with 2 hours of analysis and reports on current affairs, culture, and business. Hear from experts, authors, and editors of far-flung newspapers, as well as our own correspondents, every weekday at 2200 hours London time.
You're with Midori House on Monocle 24. It's 18:15 here in London. Now, China is nearing the end of a once-in-a-decade leadership change that has the potential to dramatically shift the direction the country heads for the next decade. Party leaders and political figures are gathered in Beijing for the annual National People's Congress, and today the session was opened by outgoing Premier Wen Jiabao. While delivering his work report to the Congress, Wen highlighted the growing imbalance between rich and poor and stressed that there was unbalanced, uncoordinated and unsustainable growth. He went on to say that consumer-led growth was the key to easing any social concerns the Chinese people might have. Later during the two-week session, Xi Jinping and Li Keqiang will be appointed president and premier. But how likely is it that leaders will focus on bridging the social divide between rich and poor? Well, to try and find out a little earlier, I spoke to Monocle regular Raffaello Pantucci, senior fellow at the Royal United Services Institute. What was your reaction to the kind of rhetoric that we've heard from the National People's Congress? We've heard from Wen Jiabao. It almost sounds like a kind of conciliatory tone and looking at unbalanced, unsustainable growth. Is this just rhetoric? Is it empty? Or do you think this represents any kind of real change in terms of the direction that we're hearing from him?
This was Wen Jiabao's sort of final big speech to the party. It was before the MPC. I think your point about it being conciliatory is true up to a point, but you know, he has always talked about a lot of the themes that he brought up. And in particular, I think an interesting theme that he brought up was this theme of stability, which is something that really emphasizes a concern that continues to exist in the Chinese Communist Party. That is the stability of the country and what that says about their legitimacy to rule it.
And just in terms of the sort of language we were hearing, though, about this acknowledgement about social problems and trying to sort of balance the growth in the country, what do you think, in real terms, is going to be, what are his successors actually going to be able to do to deliver anything on those kind of points? I mean, is it really something that they can actually address and address quickly?
I think quickly, I think it's very difficult for them to address these issues quickly. These are big problems we're talking about. I mean, the perspective of inequality is one of the running sores in the country and one that seems very difficult to solve. But I think to say that the next lot are going to be able to come in and sort of fix this problem instantly is unlikely. However, I think the point is that there's a slow path that the party at least sees that it is trying to move along. I think, again, a lot of these themes are not particularly new. They have been percolating around in the sort of Chinese body politic for a while, in particular around a figure like Wen Jiabao, who has gone to great effort to sort of make himself seen as the man of the people, who is above these sorts of corruption scandals, even though the sort of New York Times articles we saw, which sort of uncovered some of his family members being involved, you know, in the wake of that, he went to great lengths to try to clear his own name. So I think him in particular, he has always been talking about these things. I think the bigger problems are very big problems that are very difficult to address. But I think that the messages we're seeing out of this party congress of a party that is trying to sort of wrestle with these problems and figure out how it can move forwards on some of them, I think is all a positive signal. I think it's reactive to a sense of public concern that they feel.
And just on that public concern then, do you think that the next leadership are going to be facing a more vocal, perhaps not organised, resistance from the public, but do you think they will find a public who seem more capable of accessing information about environmental issues, for example, social issues, and more willing to try and, if not dissent, at least make known their displeasure? Do you think that's something that's going to preoccupy the leadership?
I think it's something else that has been a growing concern for a while. And I think one of the interesting things we've seen is as Xi Jinping has sort of ascended into his role, there's been a very careful effort to sort of manage his image. And the managed image we are being projected is very much of a strong leader figure, an individual who is not a sort of technocrat who has risen through the party ranks, but an individual who is very much in control of his destiny and is going to be able to maybe help shape the bureaucracy around him in such a way that it'll help actually address some of these fundamental problems. So I think that's very much the message they're trying to project. Now, this is in part responsive to a sense of public opinion that is quite concerned about the status quo and the fact that maybe in the past decade, some of the economic progress that's been made has not been matched by a sort of political progress, and some sort of trade-off has been made, and is that trade-off sustainable in the long term?
Now, we've seen growth targets retained at 7.5%. I just wondered about growth in another area, double-digit growth, in fact, in defence spending. Should that worry, you know, the Western powers, or is this just a question of China still kind of playing catch-up to some extent, and this is a kind of an area that they're going to continue to spend and spend heavily, and we shouldn't be concerned or worried that we're seeing such significant growth in that area?
Well, I think the increases on defense spending are something which have been of growing concern to the outside world. But I think they've been a great concern to the outside world because of the opacity of the numbers and the lack of clarity in how much this is an actual defense budget that's being spent or how much these figures are hidden away and the actual defense budget, in fact, very much larger. I think an interesting thing we've seen is in some of the analysis that has come out around the Congress is a sense that there is greater openness coming out in part in the defense figures, and numbers that were previously sort of buried in other budgets somewhere else are increasingly becoming accounted for as part of the defense budget. So in a way, it's actually becoming more open. Should the world be more concerned about this? Well, I mean, you know, this is ultimately a very large country. And as one of their ministers said, you know, large countries need large defense and large defense forces. So in many ways, it's not entirely surprising. Some of the big ticket items they're pushing forwards on the agenda at the moment, this sort of new aircraft carrier and the sort of joint, the new fifth generation fighter. I mean, these are expensive items. And it's not surprising that a country of China's, you know, size and prestige would want to have these sorts of elements to be able to project power abroad.
Raf, just finally, one final thought from you. The Communist Party then is trying to kind of become more efficient. It's trying to be, I guess, responsive to the Chinese people. But there's no signs that they're willing to relinquish any kind of political control. Is that something that they'll have to do to be seen to make progress both domestically and by in the eyes of the West? Or do you think that they will not relent from that quite singular vision that they'll still maintain?
I, you know, what you're talking about here is the party giving up its control. And this is very much its raison d'etre. And if it starts to loosen the reins of control, people start to ask, well, why do we have this party system in the first place? Why don't we have some other form of democracy, maybe more elected one? You know, at the moment, the MPC that's meeting at the moment is, in theory, an elected body. However, it's one that's very heavily weighed upon by the Communist Party, and it very much just sort of approves the legislation that the Communist Party presents to it. What's interesting, I think, is that you're seeing that some of local concerns are boiling up in the MPC and being presented to the party as issues that the people are more worried about, and the party is being more responsive to it. But in a way, they're doing this. This is a party that wants to maintain control, and that's what these parties do. They find ways of continuing to stay in power.
That was Raffaella Pantucci, Senior Fellow at the Royal United Services Institute, speaking to me a little earlier. Up next, we find out why video game geeks are in a frenzy over a new installation at the Museum of Modern Art. You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards. Now, the Museum of Modern Art in New York City may be better known for its exhibitions featuring Monets or Van Goghs, but now the museum has turned to, believe it or not, video games for its latest exhibition. The installation is called Applied Design and features 14 different video games that have been acquired by MoMA. The games include Pac-Man and even Tetris. Unmistakable sounds. That takes me back a few more years than I'd like to admit. But is it really fair to say that video games are art? Or is this just the natural evolution of contemporary art? Well, joining me now to discuss the merits of the new installation is Amano Rivetti, a writer at the Art newspaper. Amano, thanks very much for joining us on Midori House. I just wonder, what's been the kind of critical reaction to this? Is the art world, as we might expect, perhaps up in arms about this?
Well, of course, there have been a few eyebrows raised, unsurprisingly, but I'd say on the whole, results, reactions have been positive. I think the most notable thing in terms of negative reactions is that a few critics have sort of, it's been a knee-jerk reaction saying this doesn't belong in the art collection of a museum, these 14 video games, when, in fact, the curator responsible for the acquisition, who is Paola Antonelli, and she is the senior curator of architecture and design at MoMA, never intended them to be part of the art collection. It's part of the design collection, which, you can see that sort of puts a different spin on the rationale behind buying these.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just wondered then, what sort of role do you think that this kind of work will play then within the collection? Is it a question of enhancing and improving the design work? Or do you think that as people, especially people, I guess, the newer generations who've grown up with these kind of games, they kind of do expect them to enter into their own kind of aesthetic pantheon? Do you think we'll see a change in that in the years ahead?
Well, I mean, I think absolutely. I think people are starting to look at these differently, not as just video games. But it really is part of the design department at MoMA. It's part of their strategy to sort of go beyond the idea that design is purely furniture-driven. And that's really sort of the most important concept behind this exhibition, is that it's really trying to show the audiences that, it's not just furniture design, it's also interface design, everything from the way ATMs work in the street to the way video games are built. And that really does, it's a whole new pocket of design.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that, because obviously there is always a sense, I suppose, when traditional kind of practices by museums and galleries are challenged, that it can be rather hard to crack. A lot of people have preconceived ideas about it. When you get an institution like MoMA making this kind of step, even as you say, within the design rather than the art background, do you think that's important for museums and curators, some forward-looking curators, to continue to kind of push the envelope in this way?
Well, I think absolutely. I mean, if you look at the Smithsonian Museum last year in 2012, they staged an exhibition called The Art of Video Games. So it really a precursor to this exhibition at MoMA, except that this time the video games were treated really just as video games rather than as, an aspect of design. So this is just pushing, pushing the boat out a bit more. And, we shouldn't forget that, of course, MoMA has the Demoiselle painting by Picasso, which, at the time, that was scandalous and considered not art and, kind of angered a lot of people. So it just really goes to show that what angers people in one period of time, just is high art, but sort of 50 years later. So, these things carry on.
And just to sort of put you on the spot then, Amano, what's your reckoning about this? Can you see the kind of the aesthetic appeal beyond, as you said, the beauty of the code and the sort of functionality of the design of these kind of games? Do you see something that can maybe deliver on the more traditional aesthetic grounds? What's your take on it?
Well, I mean, I think it's such a different medium, I guess, from, traditional oil painting or sculpture or something, that it would be very difficult to draw a kind of direct comparison, aesthetically speaking. But, at the same time, it's a new language. It's a completely new visual language. It has a technology behind it, which previously didn't exist. So this really is the birth of something completely new. So we can only really wait and see, I think, and see where this goes.
It's fascinating stuff. Amano Rivetti, writer at the Art newspaper, thank you very much for joining me on Midori House. And now, to keep us in the mood, here's Lana Del Rey with, what else? Video games.
Swinging in the backyard, pull up in your fast car, whistling my name. Open up a beer and you say get over here and play a video game. I'm in his favorite sundress. Baby, now you do.
Lana Del Rey there with video games, of course. Now, in the next half hour of this programme, we'll head to the Geneva Motor Show and we'll find out why Rupert Murdoch is so excited about sport. But before all of that, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the latest news.
Thank you very much. Jordan's King Abdullah has called for a political transition in Syria during his official visit to Ankara, the Turkish capital, to visit President Abdullah Gül. Dutch police said today that the arrest of a Romanian woman living in the Netherlands provided insight in the audacious theft of paintings, including a Picasso and a Monet, from an art gallery in Rotterdam last October. Police in the Maldives have arrested the former president today, 10 days after he left the Indian High Commission, where he had taken refuge to avoid detention. 2,000 Greek farmers ditched their fields and took to the streets of Athens to protest against austerity measures that have caused production costs to rise while consumption has dropped. And staying with Europe, Britain was left isolated in the European Union today after it failed to secure backing to water down new EU rules limiting bankers' bonuses, a measure that could threaten London's dominance as a financial centre. That's the latest news from Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Jonathan. You're with Midori House. I'm Tom Edwards, of course. It's 1832 here in London, 1932 in Geneva, where we're heading next. The motoring world is gathered in Switzerland for the annual Geneva Motor Show. And this year, like any other, is a mix of fast cars, eco-friendly models with an eye on the environment. But whether green-focused or hot rod, they represent the very best each manufacturer has to offer. A little earlier, I spoke to Monocle's culture editor turned automotive expert, Robert Bound, who's attending the show. What things have really struck you? Who are the manufacturers maybe making a really big name for themselves today over in Geneva?
Well, Geneva is a mixture of, you know, the kind of everyman car manufacturers, the Volkswagens and Fords of this world, as well as Rolls-Royces and Ferraris and Lamborghinis. So a lot of attention is obviously thrown onto those sexier brands that are launching new cars. Ferrari have launched a new car here today, as have Rolls-Royce. Notably, Rolls-Royce brought back a ghost, literally, from 1938, a car called The Race, which there's been a lot of fuss about, and there was a bit of a leak overnight, which possibly Rolls-Royce did themselves. So there's a lot of the sexy brands bringing new things to Geneva, which is traditionally the place where you keep your powder dry until Geneva, and then you kind of launch something spectacular.
So what's been the kind of attitude then from the people you've been speaking to? Are they fairly buoyant? Are they optimistic about the future? Because we have seen before that a lot of those mainstream marks you mentioned have struggled with sales whilst the very high-end stuff continues to shift. Is that the story? Or do you think that the market generally, are people fairly optimistic about how robust it is?
People seem to be optimistic. I mean, I've spoken to Rolls-Royce today, and I've spoken to Lexus and Mercedes today. Now, these, strangely, as you said, are brands that or marks that are selling really well. Lexus have had their best 3 years of all time, the last 3 years, which is good considering they're also sort of hybrid as luxury. And the Volkswagens and Seats and Fords of this world are still keeping, are still very much riffing on green technology or blue technology as it seems to have morphed into, which is about hybrid, it's about electric, it's this sort of thing. I'm not entirely sure of exact sales figures, but there's a lot of emphasis, less perhaps on green and on shifting units, I guess, especially in terms of Mercedes-Benz and BMW and these sort of upmarket marks that aren't supercar marks. Seems like the kind of kinetic and green message is slightly getting lost, because I think it looks like they're looking at new markets and maybe heading for performance and luxury a bit more in Russia, China and South America than trying to convince these new markets that they should be going green.
And tell me, Rob, what's the kind of atmosphere then, sort of on the shop floor, as it were? We've hearing then about how the general performance of these kind of companies. What are the kind of people who are at the motor show? What's the atmosphere like? As Robert Bound strolls through the halls, what really catches his eye? What are the kind of people who are there alongside you?
Well, it's a funny old thing, a motor show. I don't know whether you've been to any of the ones in the UK or across the world, Tom. I mean, they're funny old places. For Robert Bound walking through the Geneva Motor Show, my eyes, it has to be said, my head is turned by the quite staggering amount of beautiful women draped over the cars, which is still the way that most of these marks sell their wares. It's a good way of getting PR, I guess, whether you're a,
a men's magazine or a car magazine or both. But and then obviously the people, the delegates that are coming, the people that work for the brands themselves, and the people that work in marketing for the brands. There's a lot of suits, and then there's a lot of short men in suits, a lot of tall women in heels. I'm happy with it this way because I'm dressed in jeans. I can stand out from the crowd.
And just tell me, Rob, so if I walk out in front of Midori House once you return to these shores, will I see you burning around the corner in any particular model? Have you set your eye on something you're trying to maybe take away from the show, literally?
Yeah, well, there's a nice, I'm a massive fan of those old Citroens, those old DSs, and there's the C6, I think it is, which is my favourite car. That's there last year. They've kind of souped that up a little bit. They've smoothed the lines on it a little bit. That's really lovely. There's a Lexus concept car that's twiddling around on a stand that I can see from my vantage point up here, which was premiered at Detroit, which they've brought here. And I guess it's a concept car that every time it kind of gets delivered to another fair, it gets one revolution away from being a concept car and maybe goes into production. And I have a little soft spot for that sexy Rolls-Royce Wraith that I got a chance to, you know, sit in the driver's seat off and make some brum brum noises this morning. That was pretty cool as well.
Lovely stuff. And just finally, Rob, very briefly, what does one do then of an evening at the motor show? Is there any entertainment laid on? How will you be whiling away the hours this evening?
Yeah, Morgan, that august old British sports car manufacturer, are having a drink this evening. I'm going to head there and have a glass of pop. And then I think, you know, it's still kind of technically ski season. I'm going to head over to the Banda Paki and get a fondue on a lake.
That was our Robert Bound speaking to me from the Geneva Motor Show a little earlier. You're with Midori House. We'll be right back after this with a look at why Stalin is still dividing opinion 60 years on.
If you're looking for a present for a loved one, something for the home, or some luggage to take on the road, why not visit one of our shops? Our beautifully appointed shops in London, New York, Toronto, Hong Kong and Tokyo sell a selection of the fruits of our collaborations with a number of our favourite brands, including Porter, Hackett, Ettinger, Barena and many others too. Plus, we can also help out filling in any gaps in your collection of back issues. So why not visit any of our shops today? You're guaranteed a very warm welcome.
The Review is Monocle 24's weekly review and preview of the arts. Every Saturday, we take a relaxed look back at the books, TV shows, films, music, theatre and events that have made our week, while looking around the corner to scout out the next big thing.
It doesn't feel sappy, it doesn't feel sentimental, it does have a certain heft.
It's very Darwinian. The shows that do well run and the ones that don't close, and there have been some quite high-profile flops and some great successes as well.
For me, it's riotous, it's tasteless, but it's actually dynamic as well, it has momentum.
Join Monocle's editors as they sit down with our favourite critics, opinion makers and key industry figures for some in-depth discussion and lively debate. And we provide inspiration for the weekend from cities around the world.
It's a real divider because I know some people just love this film and other people really just hate it.
That's A Review, every Saturday at midday London time and across the weekend, right here on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House. Up next, we head to Georgia to consider the legacy of Joseph Stalin. But to take us there, here's the Russian singer Tatiana Kochkareva with Roses.
I think we're through.
Why
That was Tatiana Kochkareva with Roses. You're listening to Midori House. The time is 1844 here in London. Now we consider the legacy of Joseph Stalin. 60 years after the death of the Soviet leader, opinion remains divided about how he should be remembered. And in his homeland of Georgia, the debate over whether to commemorate such a man, and indeed how exactly that should be done, still divides the country. This week, plans were announced to restore to prominence a huge Soviet-era statue of Stalin in his hometown, Gori, where he apparently remains a popular figure. Despite Georgians' fierce independence and generally pro-Western political bias, there's still nostalgia for the despot. Why can that be? Monocle's editor Andrew Tuck spoke to Donald Rayfield, Emeritus Professor of Russian and Georgian at Queen Mary, University of London, to find out exactly why.
Why do you feel that in Georgia there still is this kind of nostalgia for the man?
Well, it's a nostalgia that not all the population shares. I think educated Georgians, generally speaking, know that in their family there's usually at least one, often more, people who were shot or sent to Siberia by Stalin. They know that the country is missing perhaps 500,000 people because of Stalin's atrocities. 50,000 people shot in the 1930s. Third of a million Georgian males killed to no good reason in some of the campaigns of the Second World War. They don't have any illusions. But among the peasantry and among certain groups like Ossetian villagers, there's a perverse pride in Stalin as a tough leader who may have slaughtered a lot of people but slaughtered a lot of Georgia's enemies as well as Georgians. It's very difficult to understand. In Soviet times, you noticed, for instance, truck drivers had pictures of Stalin in their lorries. He was a sort of St. Christopher medal. He's almost a sort of god figure.
Do you think it's a little bit like when we look at modern Italy today? And we did a story here a few weeks ago, actually looking at how Mussolini's reputation, despite all the things he did, including sending many Jewish people to their deaths, he still has this kind of resonance for many ordinary Italians who feel that he harks back to a time of strength and of prosperity for the country, of a kind of cohesion that kind of is missing today.
It's a question of national glory, yes. I mean, Mussolini, however horrible he was, and compared with Stalin, he was an angel, he still put Italy on the map. Other nations took him into account. And the same can be said of Stalin. I suppose it's an odd fact that we don't mind the Mongolians putting up statues to Genghis Khan, or the Uzbeks putting up statues to Tamerlane, or the Hungarians naming their children Attila after Attila the Hun, or for that matter the Greeks worshipping Alexander the Great, who all behaved roughly as Stalin did, executing their nearest and dearest, their allies, and killing large numbers of neighboring countries' populations. But I think we need centuries to pass before we can accept this, and the Stalin cult, which is, I think, among certain peasantry, among certain in some villages and in the town of Gori, is very hard for outsiders and for educated people to stomach.
Now, we reference Gori there, but within the former Soviet Union, does his reputation still hold sway elsewhere as well?
I'm afraid you'll find that in parts of Central Asia, they see nothing wrong with Stalin. It's their idea of what a leader should be, going back to the traditions of Genghis Khan. In Russia, you can see from recent television programs, there's a systematic rehabilitation of Stalin, as if the terrible killings of the 1930s were somehow justified, were a legitimate price to pay for making the Soviet Union a strong, feared nation.
Now, in Georgia, you know, Mikhail Saakashvili, when he was in power, he was kind of obviously keen to present the country as very pro-Western, keen to modernize, keen to shake off the kind of the shackles of its past and reinvent itself. Do you think that the putting up of this statue, which I guess in some way has the tacit support of central government as well, because it is such an international PR thing, I'm sure they wouldn't allow it to go ahead if they didn't believe in it. Do you feel that within Georgia, maybe in some of the upper echelons as well, there's now a beginning to be some warmth for the man as well?
I'm not sure it's warmth. I think the new government, it's very hard to know actually what's in the minds of Bidzin Ivanishvili, even though he's been in power for some 5 months now. There is a sort of petty desire to undo everything Saakashvili did, the good things and the bad things. And one of the things that Saakashvili did was to try and demolish and send to junkyards all the statues of Stalin. And under Ivanishvili, they've been coming back. Sometimes people come out at night and paint them pink. and make fun of them. But in Gori, where he was born, of course, the museum was something that Saakashvili tried to turn into a museum of the Soviet occupation, and it seems to be now reverting to something glorifying Stalin. I can't believe that the echelons of the government really think highly of Stalin. I fear that they are going too far in their eagerness to mend relations with Russia. That may be part of the problem, but it's a sort of cocking a fist at Saakashvili and all he did. They're undoing dozens of good things that he did, as well as the bad things. And this restoration of Stalin monument seems to be one of the more stupid things to do.
That was Donald Rayfield from the University of London talking to our editor Andrew Tuck a little earlier. Our next stop is New York City.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24. This is Monocle 24. London, New York, Tokyo. Tokyo. London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
You're with Midori House, with me, Tom Edwards. For Rupert Murdoch, a television sports network has long been the missing piece in his media empire. It's the one thing that has eluded his conglomerate, News Corporation. But now, Murdoch's puzzle may be about to be completed. On Tuesday, Fox announced that it will launch an all-sports channel in the US that will compete against the Disney-owned ESPN. But what can we expect from the channel, and could it actually change the television landscape? Well, joining us from New York is Monocle's Barrett Austin to answer that question and fill us in on a few more stories making news in North America. Barrett, good to speak to you. Thanks for joining us, as always, on Midori House. So tell me a little bit about this Fox Sports initiative. What's the background to this story?
Well, you've just said it yourself. It seems that News Corp and Rupert Murdoch are really doing what they can to really increase their investment in the sports broadcast market. If you ask any American who broadcasts sports here in the U.S., the idea is that it's essentially ESPN. ESPN has for decades own the American sports broadcasting business in this country. But now for the first time, it seems that News Corp is really doing what they can to jump into this business full throttle. It seems they're going to be investing a lot of time and energy into really making this happen over the next couple of months.
Now, tell us a little bit about what exactly they face then. What kind of rival in ESPN? They're well renowned, as you say. They have some of the kind of key programs, but they also have these big cable subscriptions, don't they? Which means big bucks. What kind of an animal is it that Murdoch's trying to tackle here?
I mean, generally speaking, ESPN has some 100 million subscribers who pay something like $6 per month for their subscriptions. So each year, in addition to advertising revenue, they're getting around $6 billion purely from subscriptions. As far as content goes, ESPN broadcasts most of the major sports, so basketball, football, baseball, in addition to a whole other range of things that they broadcast across some eight subsidiary regional channels that they have around the country. But I mean, it's something that they have full control over at this time in the country.
And tell me about what Fox can expect in terms of access, because I know a lot of the big franchises in the US, you think of the likes of New York Yankees, who sort of embody so much about all that's great in American sports. You know, can Fox gain access to show these kind of games, or is this all tied up in, you know, internal deals that those big franchises have with their own broadcasters or with these other big subscribers? You know, is it a nut that Fox Sports can actually crack?
I think, at least for the next couple of years, ESPN already has broadcast rights for a number of the sort of key sporting markets in this country. That being said, News Corp comes into this whole argument with lots and lots and lots of money. It's an organization that has very deep pockets. And as you said, Rupert Murdoch has been trying for years now to really sort of enter this market and do it well. You know, in the next couple of years, you're going to see NFL, NBA, MLB with all sorts of renewal contracts up for option. And, you know, it wouldn't surprise me to see a scenario in which Fox Sports One ends up getting some of the broadcast rights for this. And sort of beyond this, I think that the Fox Sports One is really going to do everything that it can to create good quality original content. ESPN already has SportsCenter, which is the great sort of daily sports news show, which, you know, American sports fans are very loyal to. But I think it's very much Fox Sports 1's intention to launch something that would perhaps rival that.
And tell me, Barrett, you know, this is a big media story. Media watchers, especially there on the East Coast, love to get their teeth stuck in. What do they make of this? Do they think it's insanity from News Corp? Do they think it's a good effort to try and get into a potentially very lucrative market? What's the sort of media response looking in on one of their own?
I think naturally looking at this, it seems very much like a David and Goliath story. ESPN, as I've said, really sort of owns the sports broadcast market in this country. But again, I think that Fox News and News Corp wouldn't really be sort of jumping into all of this if they didn't think there was a real chance that they could make some revenue off of this. Most media analysts are saying that News Corp is really not going to give ESPN a real run for its money in the next couple of years, but at the same time, it is something that is going to produce revenue. As far as what all of their content will look like, it's difficult to say at this point. But I think the common consensus is that ESPN will live beyond this. But at the same time, maybe in the next 5 to 10 years, Fox Sports 1, if it's still around, can really, you know, sort of jostle for market share.
Now, Barrett, I want to ask you about a couple of other stories making headlines on that side of the pond. It's interesting, here in London, we've seen a real rally today, the FTSE 100 up at a five-year high. And it's the same story, isn't it, over there. Despite all the sequestration worries that we were talking about towards the end of last week, I gather it's a good news day for the Dow Jones.
It is. If you look at any sort of financial news reporting sites in this country, you'll see smiles on any investors' faces. The Dow Jones has now increased beyond 14,000 points. It's been at this point for a couple of weeks now, but today it's reached a high that exceeds the pre-recession highs in 2007. All of this, as you said, in the midst of this whole conversation about sequestration, seems a little bit ironic. But if you look at a number of issues that are sort of coming into play today, corporations have recently announced, you know, record-breaking profits. If you look at a city like Detroit, the city of Detroit obviously is not in a good position, but its big corporations, GM, Ford, et cetera, all of these companies have been announcing big profits and finally announcing bonuses again. Beyond this, you see some sort of return of stability to the housing market. Banks are slowly but surely starting to lend again. So I think the whole sequestration issue has kind of been baked into the market at this point. And if today's news is any sign of what's to come, I think it's all quite optimistic.
Now, finally, Barrett, just very briefly, I wanted to ask you about a slightly bizarre story out of your city about drone spotting. We've talked about military and police use before. What's happened today?
This obviously is a story that I am very excited to talk about. It seems just a couple of hours ago, there was an Alitalia pilot who was coming in from Rome, and just as he was about to land at JFK, he reported seeing an unmanned aerial vehicle, what he referred to as a drone, flying around 1,500 feet, just 4 to 5 miles away. At this point, it's not really clear what it was, but at the same time, you've got the FAA, the FBI, and a number of sort of counterterrorism agencies who are giving very serious attention to this, doing their part to investigate it and make sure that there's nothing malicious. I think the common consensus is that there are a number of sort of recreationalists who have these small unmanned helicopters that they fly. The FAA stipulates that they're not meant to be flown above 400 feet. That doesn't mean that someone who's a little trigger happy with a small, mini baby helicopter over in a place like Brooklyn wouldn't send it up, you know, as high as 1,500 feet.
It sounds like perhaps a model aircraft, but maybe flown not by a model citizen. Barrett Austin in New York City, thanks as always for joining us here on Midori House. Well, I'm afraid that's all we have time for on today's show. My thanks to our producer, Phil Hahn, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and Barbara Feeney, and of course, our studio manager, Ben Jay. Next on Monocle 24 is Section D. In 3 hours' time, at 2200 hours, Tom Burgess-Watson and Andrew Muller will be back for the Monocle Daily. Andrew Tuck will bring you Midori House at the same time tomorrow. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.